Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This is the John Fugelsang Podcast.
Welcome. How you doing? It's Progress After Dark. Thank you, Dino Badala, for the excellent lead-in that I can never hope to measure up to. I'm Fugelsang, aided and abetted by the most dangerous production squad in radio, Chris Hauselt, running this beast out of South Carolina, the great Thea Harper producing our show out of Brooklyn for the next 3 hours. We're going to be coming at you with facts, empathy, music, and something resembling, but not quite achieving, wit. Let's do a show. It's OJ time. I never thought I'd be talking about this guy on this show, but the Hall of Fame athlete, turned actor, turned, well, you know, a guy whose murder trial literally changed American culture and American media, has died at the age of 76 of prostate cancer. Now, I know what you're all wondering. Is the tumor okay? I know. Let's talk about OJ. Let's talk about it tonight, because if you're like me, this has been a part of your consciousness most of your life. And of course, this June marks the 30-year anniversary of the murders. A lot of us grew up with this. A lot of us have lived with this story for a very long time. And I want to know, how do you feel this has changed your culture? How did this change our media? How did it change our politics? In talking about the impact the O.J. Simpson case had on our culture, there are so many angles to approach. Obviously, the media talks a lot about the role of race, but even more, it's the role of class. It's about domestic violence and how women aren't taken seriously. It's also about our current media culture and how we got to the kind of 24/7 cable news cycle we are all currently enjoying. So Dina Dahl is a lawyer and legal analyst, regularly seen on Midas Touch, the Law and Crime Network, the Young Turks, and more. She's given legal analysis on all the high-profile cases in the past couple of years, including George Floyd, Prince Andrew, Kyle Rittenhouse, Britney Spears. She can cover everything from the Texas abortion law to Smartmatic to Harvey Weinstein. You can follow her on TikTok, X, and Instagram. Welcome back, Dina Dahl. Hello. It's good to have you.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, the man was getting old. It shouldn't be that much of a surprise he's left us, and yet it's still such a shock. Just 2 months before the 30-year anniversary of this murder that seemingly changed so much of our media culture. I began the show by saying I think that a lot of this began with the first Iraq war, the popular war to restore the dictator of Kuwait, when we first began to have this 24/7 cable news dominating the headlines for weeks on just one story. O.J. Simpson, where do we begin to talk about the careers that were made from this and the media culture that was spawned by this? What were your initial thoughts when you heard about his passing today?
You know, you're right. I mean, he was older, but people like him who are kind of legendary, bigger than life, it is always surprising when you hear about their passing. And, you know, you mentioned all the different true crime cases that I've covered, and he is the original true crime case. If it wasn't for him, none of this other, court TV wouldn't be there. Law and Crime wouldn't be there. I mean, CNN sometimes will cover, you know, criminal trials. The Murdoch trial was their programming. People, there's a huge interest in the public around live criminal trials, and it resulted from him. And the interesting thing about that is we have, you know, the defendants have a constitutional right to a fair trial, right? And so the idea of having cameras in the courtroom or having publicity around your case, the concern is, can that defendant get a fair trial? And this was the biggest test case of this. And the fact that he got acquitted is why we still have so many cameras in the courtroom, because it showed that you had him have the most publicity that had ever been seen, the most people watching it live in the cameras, and it didn't harm him. He got acquitted. And so you can actually think, you know, obviously a lot of people disagree with that outcome, but you can actually think his acquittal for why there are still cameras in the courtroom. Because if he had been convicted after all of that publicity and the cameras, there would have been a huge question of whether or not it was fair to allow cameras in the courtroom, or whether or not that was going to harm a defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial. But because with as much as they attention as it got, he was acquitted, that was answered in a way that to this day, like almost 30 years later, it's not really brought up again, right?
So
for the
brilliant.
Most part,
yeah.
That's no longer a question because he was that test case. And so fair or not fair, it has allowed a lot more public access to the courtrooms as a result of his acquittal.
I have to confess, that's an angle of this I never thought of. We focus all the time on all the negative and trashy things that came to our culture from this. But you're right. I'm a big fan of cameras in courtrooms. I think we should have cameras in the Supreme Court. I think execution should be televised. I think all of it should be aired. Everything our taxes pay for, I want to see on TV. But I never really thought about the fact that you're right. If OJ had been convicted, it would have led to a big movement against this. I also feel like we hear all the time about the trash of this and how the media was just so focused on just this one case and it was out of proportion. But I always felt even at the time that the reality was, and I got a lot of pushback from this, but there had never been a person in the history of this country of this stature and fame on trial for murder. I mean, it's incredibly historically significant, and I find it ironic and coincidental that he dies on the eve of the first ever former president going on trial. I mean, all these firsts just link up when it comes to celebrities and criminal law.
Absolutely. And I want to definitely answer that question. And then as a side note, how sad is it that the criminal trial that started next week is not televised?
Please.
And, you know, being
can we talk about that, please?
I was a journalist before I went to law school, and it really is bothering me that the federal trials are not being televised, that the New York trial is not being televised. It's not that they cannot. They just have these rules. The prosecutors could have been requesting the rules to be changed. Would it have been an exception? Yes. Maybe for a former president, an exception can be made. It's really frustrating to me. I think we all would be benefiting. The Georgia live hearings, a ton of people are listening and really understanding the issues. And I wish the other ones were to be too. But anyway, as a side note.
Can I just agree with you wholeheartedly? Because we are the American people. We are paying for this. This concerns the future of our democracy. And the voters, I mean, just for the functions of democracy, deserve to know the details of all these cases. It concerns us and it concerns our descendants.
Absolutely. And we shouldn't have to get a recap from a correspondent, because I might be looking at that witness testimony differently than that correspondent's recap. And I have to say that, you know, I interact a lot with people on social media, and I will... The things that people ask me after they've been watching the trial for themselves are like usually right on point. And I just think it's a shame that people aren't able to get their own perspective from the witnesses themselves or the openings or the closings and make their own determination. Why can't we just all decide for ourselves in addition to the 12 jurors? Because, and back to the OJ one, you know, we all saw the mistakes that they were making in real time. So that's although right. at the time, everyone thought it was unfair that he probably did it and was there race involved, there was also, you know, the famous line, the Johnny Cochran line, if it doesn't fit, you've got to acquit. We all heard that. That was so memorable that we talk about it 30 years later. Of course, it was going to make a difference to that jury. So although we maybe don't fully some people may don't fully agree with the outcome. They understood the outcome because exactly. they could see the excellence of his argument. And it's such a shame that in a Trump situation, that same thing isn't going to happen.
It's true. I mean, they broke the timeline, and the Mark Furman sideshow was devastating in terms of bringing up a reasonable doubt in terms of the case. And also, we've come a long way in terms of forensic science since then. I mean, in terms of DNA analysis, you know, it was a very messy crime scene. And as has been documented, it was a very messy collection of evidence. I felt like we all had a bit of a civics lesson. We all had a bit of an amateur law school. I mean, I really liked how much people learned about how the courts work from that. We can't do it all from Law and Order reruns. And for a endless 2 years of this, Americans were really glued to how our process works. That is one of the unsung benefits that came to our culture from this circus.
Absolutely. I mean, we have public courtrooms for a reason. They're meant to be public, and the cameras are only there because we can't all fit in the room. But we have public courtrooms, and we do all learn so much from it and from watching. And we see, the DNA. I think that is such a great point, because that was really one of the early ones. And when the defense, question, oh, but you can only determine this 99%, you know, like as if there was some wiggle room there, right? And because it was so foreign, it wasn't something. Now, DNA evidence alone is like the strongest evidence you can have in a case, and that will convict somebody. But at the time, that wasn't as strong. People didn't quite understand it. And if it wasn't like 100%, what did that mean? You know, and so that wasn't as strong as it for sure would have been now. And the other thing too, that I think really harmed them in getting a conviction, was how long the prosecutors put on their case. Because if you remember, they sequestered those people, which is really not very common. And in fact, in a lot of the high publicity trials we see now, they're not sequestered at all. Mm-hmm. Maybe during deliberation, but that's it. But this jury was sequestered for like 8 months just for the prosecution's case. I can't imagine like how upset I would be if I couldn't see my family for 8 months. And then I'd be like, if you're not putting on the case of the century at this point, you know, you're wasting my time. That's stunning to me that they did that.
Yeah. I mean, some of them got book deals, but yeah, I mean, it was just, it's hard to imagine that happening now. Also, another thing, you know, we'd always had famous lawyers. I mean, William Jennings Bryan, Clarence Darrow, there's nothing new there. But the super squad of lawyers, this like Suicide Squad Avengers team of guys that were differing levels of moral turpitude, but were all very good at their jobs and fascinating to watch. I will confess that one of the, I hate to call it a pleasure of the trial, but one of the most fascinating parts was watching F. Lee Bailey and Johnny Cochran and Robert Shapiro and the profoundly different ways all of these guys took money to get a murderer off. I mean, the sheer talent of his legal squad, looking back on it, is we've never seen anything like it ever since. It was the best legal defense a celebrity's money could buy.
Absolutely. And as a lawyer, I have to say, it matters a lot who your lawyer is representing you. You would think maybe it shouldn't, but it does. It's quite, and that's quite, why personally, I really feel like we need to fund our public defender's office a lot more, because, you know, they are juggling so many different cases. And then you have this squad, as you say, these high elite things, they're going to be able to put on a defense that acquits him, whereas a typical criminal defendant who cannot afford that is getting a very big separate treatment. And I think that these kind of real factors impacted the verdict in a way that back then it really seemed to people wanted it to be all about race. And it made sense in some ways, because this was happening so soon after the Rodney King riots in LA. And there was the city was still really in the middle of that.
That's right.
And I feel like there was like a reaction of wanting this to be about race. I mean, obviously it was a biracial couple, and then the city was still really healing from that. But there's so many legal reasons why he was acquitted. And I think over time, those have become more obviously the reasons why he was acquitted than race. I really feel like race was a reaction to like what was happening in the moment.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of folks at the time who spun this or tried to spin it as a bit of a David and Goliath story. And no, poor black men are treated one way and rich black men are treated the way rich white men are treated. And that's what we learned from that trial. I want to ask you one more question, Dina, about a somewhat unrelated story. But we got a bit of breaking news about O.J. Simpson today from someone who used to work at USC and was under an NDA. The story was just released earlier that in early 95, Robert Shapiro and Robert Kardashian came to USC because when he had been a student, apparently OJ allegedly had dated two different blonde women and committed violent battery on both of them. And they paid off the university to cover up these stories. Should we be expecting more of this? You know, we're going to be getting a real lesson in NDAs from Donald Trump. And I was wondering today if people are going to start coming out with damaging new information about O.J. Simpson now that he had committed violent acts against women and it was covered up previously. My God, what's going to happen when Trump dies? I mean, is a person automatically freed from the terms of their NDA when the subject passes on?
I think it depends how it's drafted.
Okay,
I mean, I would say probably in almost every situation, it would expire because you no longer have an interest in keeping that secret. But technically, I don't see why it can't be drafted to be, you know, a certain period of time, even let's say after somebody passes, like 10 years or 20 years, or, you know, I imagine you can kind of draft that in. But the longer you have an NDA for, you're more you're going to pay for it, too. So it's why if you're passed away, maybe you don't care anymore if that secret comes out. So I would think in most situations it would expire, you know, upon somebody's death. And that's interesting. I imagine Trump probably does have a bunch of NDAs that could get interesting afterwards. And that would be a really disturbing story about USC. I imagine more is going to be reported about it, whether or not how factual it is or not factual it is. But I mean, it's my alma mater. I went there for undergrad in law school, and that would be really disappointing if they were willing to pay to, you know, it's one thing if they actually paid the women, but it's a whole other thing if the university was willing to cover something like that up.
Yeah, I think we'll be learning a lot more of this story in the days to come. Dina, before I let you go, what do you think the history books will say in the long view of this incredible media circus and trial? I mean, it's been a pleasure with talking with you about some of the beneficial things that came from it. Do you think history will remember it as trashily as it seemed at the time?
You know, I do think it, like you said, it did change our culture. It was one of those events, you know, you have a fork in your road, and it did kind of forever change it. And it made us more vested, maybe, let's say, in celebrities' lives in a way even that we weren't before.
Amen. Dina Dahl, it is always an honor to have you on our show. Thank you so much for coming here on this date. What is the best way for our listeners to follow you and keep up with all your work and brilliance?
You know, I'm at Ask Dina Dahl. I do a weekly Trump recap video. It's like a minute and a half every Friday. I put it out on X and Instagram just so people can kind of keep up to date on all his many, many trials.
We have four more we're looking forward to after two have already happened this year. He did make the pyramid scheme one go away. So that's one down, but four more to go. Please join us a lot over the next coming year. It's going to be a fascinating year and we need all the legal expertise we can get.
Thanks for having me.
This is Progress After Dark. We'll be right back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back. This is SiriusXM. So 39 million Americans are caring right now for an ailing loved one. Maybe you're one of them. Maybe at some point in your life you have been one of them. Maybe you're realizing at some point you will be caring for someone or someone you know will be caring for you. Sarah Cart was raised in New York and New England, and as a freelancer, she wrote for many local publications while she and her husband, Ben, raised their kids in Ohio. When they became empty nesters, they moved to the Florida Keys. Then came COVID-19. And 2 weeks in, her husband, Ben, developed an incurable autoimmune condition that was manageable and under control 1 minute and then was threatening his very life the next. It landed him in the ICU just as the COVID pandemic was shutting America down. Suddenly, Sarah joined the ranks of those 39 million Americans thrust unexpectedly into the role of nurse and caregiver. Her book, On My Way Back to You, is a firsthand account of the roller coaster world of life-saving transplants and the incredible challenges she faced as she tried to manage her husband's illness and save his life and their marriage and her sanity while a plague was going on all around them. It's a very moving book that is more than a great story. It is a story that will also prepare you for when you join that very big club. It's a great pleasure to welcome Sarah Cart to SiriusXM Progress. Hello.
Hello, John. Thank you very much for having me. Thrilled
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
Thank you very much for joining us. I got to say, your story is very moving. I was mentioning to you that my mom was a geriatric care nurse and a hospice nurse, and I grew up around a lot of what you're describing here, and I've seen lots of people thrust into that role. I have to ask, what was it that motivated you to turn this whole experience into a book right now?
I tend to write so that I can process information, process reality. I didn't write very much when our four boys were growing up because life was so chaotic. But I have found as I'm getting older, the more stressful things get, if I have the time, it helps me put my head back in the right place. So
it's incredible to read how 2 weeks after the lockdown began, when everyone's so concerned about your health, you realize that your husband Ben's body was shutting down. And what was the process between his symptoms beginning and then the realization that you had to get on the list for a transplant in the middle of a plague?
Well, actually, his autoimmune began a few years earlier, but it was manageable. We were managing it symptom by symptom. It would migrate from organ to organ and diagnosis to diagnosis. And sometimes we were really on top of it, and sometimes we weren't. The first summer when he had it, he unexpectedly lost about 30 pounds, which he didn't really have to lose. But that was as the, it's called systemic sclerosis, and it had taken mm-hmm. over his GI tract. So that was one learning opportunity. And then the next summer, he developed congestive heart failure, and we got a pacemaker, and the pacemaker was keeping up until the following summer when we were told we should be considering getting on the transplant list. And so that's what we were working on. It's a long, complicated process. And Ben was actually actively dying as 2020 began. And then he failed a kidney. He failed some blood work. His kidneys were crashing 2 weeks after the pandemic began. And our GP happened to see the blood work. It was actually taken by a different doctor because we had so many doctors looking at so many different things at that point. And he called at 5 o'clock on a Friday night and said, Ben needs to be in an ICU right now. And I asked, I mean, are we really sending him into the belly of the beast because this virus is going around? And
exactly.
He said it was the safest place for him. So that's what we did.
And as you point out in the book, your husband was a very active man, a very healthy man, not out of shape and someone who was always, you know, extremely vigorous in his life.
Yeah, we call him the ever-ready bunny, Tigger. He doesn't sit still for long. He sleeps for about 4 hours a day, you know, out of 24. And so he was a great dad. It was great raising four crazy and wild boys with him because he could keep up with them. And then all of a sudden, he really couldn't. And it It surprised our boys. It surprised me. It was really hard to watch. We had the pleasure and joy of taking our oldest son and his four children and his wife to Disney World right as 2020 began. And Ben did all of that in a wheelchair. And that was really a sobering moment for our son to see, because he doesn't live in Florida with us.
Of course.
So you can do the smoke and mirrors over the phone and over Zoom, but the reality of being with us day to day was pretty harsh.
That's what I'm curious about. As your husband began developing one life-threatening condition after another, what were some of the questions that went through your mind? Because you went through the entire process.
Yeah, there were a lot of questions. And they were, we shared them together. Ben is very scientifically minded. So the scientist in him was fascinated by each development and how a new medication could alleviate thus and such, but would have this other side effect. And he was wrapping his head around all of that. I'm an English major, so I was overwhelmed. But we were going through it knowing that he was probably going to die. And he wanted to help me face that. And so he was really good about trying to educate me about the things I would need to understand. And he would ask, what are you scared of besides losing me? And I would say, I'm overwhelmed at the thought of handling the insurance and the taxes and all the things to do with home ownership. And he would take me through, he taught me that, no, you can't just pay it, ignore that little light on the dashboard, for example. But also the weighty stuff, like what did he want us to do with his remains? How did he want to be remembered? How did he want his memory to be honored? And through that whole process, I think it actually brought us closer. And I think at the time I was thinking, these will be some of my fondest memories of this guy that I've loved after I've lost him. So we got through it that way.
You not only had to deal with the understandable doubts and fears that anybody in your position would face, but you're doing this handling all of these repeated setbacks and the red tape and the COVID restrictions during the pandemic. What were some of the new skills that you had to learn? What were some of the new things that you had to adapt to? Because in the book, your whole life changed. The way you viewed everything changed.
I got good at, before he went in the hospital, there was an episode of having to do IV antibiotics. And I don't do blood typically. I don't do needles, but I got so that I could put the smelling salts down long enough to do the PICC line and all of that. Then the night that he went in the hospital was actually the first night I ever did a Zoom call. So there were technological skills that I learned, acquired. Lots of things. Managing his medications, taking notes, getting very good at listening to a radiologist or a technician or whichever medico happened to call me to say, we need your consent for this. And typically you'd be in the hospital and they'd be able to explain the procedure to you, but I was having to listen to it all over the phone and state my name, state his birthday, state my consent for, and describe the procedure so that they have it all on tape. And in the moment, I knew a lot. Since then, I have forgotten. It's kind of like being pregnant. You forget what it was all about because otherwise it would overwhelm you.
And you're going through this at a time when you can't see friends for support. You can't go to a restaurant to get a break where you're either homebound or in a doctor's office or in a hospital. And you say how you want to try and exhaust all resources to help your ailing loved one, but at the same time, you can quickly become utterly exhausted, going on empty fumes, anxiety, and mostly uncertainty. I wonder, were you also dealing with the dread on top of that? The concern of, am I doing enough? Everyone I've ever talked to who's gone through a caretaker experience or a hospice experience always feels that overwhelming existential worry that there's more I could be doing. It sounds like your hands were very full.
There were many, many times where I just felt if I could walk into the hospital room and see so that my questions could get answered and maybe I would see things that other people hadn't noticed yet. That was very, very frustrating. And yet at the same time, everybody was going through something. It was COVID. I thought I would never see my husband again. There were people who literally were not seeing their spouses again or their children or their parents and didn't have the luxury of being able to go say goodbye.
To say nothing of the fear that your husband could contract COVID in such an impaired state with so many immunity problems while in a hospital. Now, you interviewed, or you choose to have your sons speak for this book, and they give some thoughts, and your husband, Ben, as well. I'm not really spoiling the surprise to say that he's still with us, but one of your husband's quotes that really stayed with me was, he said, "I'm pretty scientific rather than emotional. So at first, I was detached." I'm curious, what was his emotional journey? And did he, as a man, struggle at all with achieving some kind of grace and letting himself be cared for?
The hardest time for him, early on, he was, as I've said before, he was very scientific about it and fascinated by it. And anytime a new doctor would walk into the room, or anybody new, he was excited to meet somebody new. That's just the way he is. So oftentimes doctors would talk to him for about 5 minutes and then say, I spent all day yesterday going over your chart. And if I had not read your chart, or if they'd handed me your chart and then had you talk to me, I would never have put the two together. He just totally belied everything that they had read. But the emotional journey really kicked him in the gut with the congestive heart failure diagnosis. That is what was on his beloved grandfather's death certificate. And the day the doctor said that, I could tell he was welling up. And he'll cry on occasion, but this was different. He'll cry for happiness, or he'll cry for joy, but this was different. This was fear and shock. And that was a really quiet ride home after that doctor's appointment. Moving on from that, as soon as they said, "Oh, a heart transplant can save you," he was like, "Okay, well then let's do that." I mean, he just kind of reinvigorated him, and he was like, "Okay, that's what we'll do." The problem was, as he was getting sicker and sicker, his executive function was disappearing. He reached a point where if he could have slept 24 hours a day, he would have, but he couldn't sleep. He had spasms that kept waking him up. And so he basically became a wonderfully good-natured 10-year-old boy. Fun to be with, but not really helpful with making any decisions or moving the ball forward in terms of disability claims or insurance paperwork. And that was really scary, because he's smart and he's my best friend, and we should be having conversations about this, that, and the other thing. And we were really reduced to very simple conversations. "Would you like to go see the sunset?" "Yes, let's go see if we can see some dolphins." Right. And that was hard.
We're going to take a very quick break. We'll be right back. This is Progress.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back. My guest is Sarah Cart. She's the author of the new book, On My Way Back to You, One Couple's Journey Through Catastrophic Illness to Healing and Hope. And of course, as I mentioned at the top, 39 million Americans right now are caring for an ailing loved one. And as you note in your book, sooner or later, everyone will either become a caregiver or need one. On the one hand, your book is this very moving personal narrative story, but it's also, I think, a book you can use. You dispense a lot of very helpful wisdom here. Let me ask you, how can one begin to prepare for such an emotionally and physically demanding role. I mean, it is true that none of us really start to prepare until it's thrust upon us, and then we have to improvise usually. What should one do when they first find themselves about to enter this arena?
If you have a faith practice to begin with, it's helpful to have something like that to lean into. It doesn't have to be a church or a synagogue or a temple. It can be yoga or meditation. I've mentioned that I like journaling. I also, we raised our family in the Episcopal Church. So a lot of those prayers came back to me. Finding your roots, if your roots are deep, they sustain you. And so that was very helpful for me. I have to admit, I went back and forth sometimes in the middle of the night, thinking for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health. That was a pretty powerful vow that we took when we were very young. And it means something completely different when you are absolutely staring it in the face. And I would wonder, you know, when could I have said no? And you go back and you review years of friendship and adventures, and there was really no time I ever would have said no to where we ended up. But the vows were really important to me.
Yeah. What are some of the more important questions that you need to ask yourself and ask your loved ones to help move through this process when the time comes? I mean, most people, I must say, who'll go through it are probably, hopefully, not going to be going through it as you did with a worldwide pandemic. But what are the important questions that you need to ask yourself and of others to move through the process?
It's all the stuff that they ask you when you're filling out the living will paperwork. And fortunately, we had already done that. So we'd had some of those conversations. But again, when you're actually coming face to face with it, you go back and you review those conversations about when are you willing to have a feeding tube? When are you willing to be on a breathing machine? What kinds of end of life decisions do you want made for you? What would you like us to consider? It helps if you've had those conversations before you need to. But as I say, it's very different when you're then in the thick of it to realize this is what we were talking about. One of the things that the hospital gave us when he was close to getting on the transplant list, but was not yet on it, was a book all about heart transplants. It starts with the really basic how the heart works and goes through the whole process of when you get the call and what you bring your medications with you and when you stop eating and all these things before surgery. And there were also some notes in that book about complications. And I had read it. I'd read it with a highlighter and circled things and written all kinds of notes in the margins. And then when he really went into surgery, I pulled the book out again, and it's the same thing. You're now reading it and it's real. It strikes you so differently. The important questions are, how do you want to be remembered?
Wow.
What would you like me to do for you in thus and such a case? And it's, And we had those conversations with our kids too about him. And the boys were wonderful about visiting dad. And I mean, all this is pre-COVID. Our last Thanksgiving together, we were all together in November of 2019, and the weather in New England was less than cooperative. And so everybody, instead of leaving on Sunday, we all left at like 6 o'clock Saturday. It was really rushed. We were rushing to Florida. The rest of the family was rushing up into New England. And then we didn't see each other again until May of 2021.
Oh,
it was
18
months.
Yeah. Your
and
kids
so
must
I'm
have
really
been
glad
beside
that
themselves.
Had the conversations we had.
Your sons must have been beside themselves with worry the entire time.
They were, but they were also really good about tag teaming with each other. I think in its own way, it made the four of them closer. They, you know, have you talked to mom? No. Hey, it's your turn. Or hey, I got through to dad. Here's what dad did. Dad call you at 6:30 this morning and ask how things are in your bunker? Because he was on some wild meds after the transplant. It was a trip. He gave Stephen King a run for his money when he started telling us the stories of what he thought was going on. Just nuts stuff.
Can I ask, what are some of the more practical pieces of advice you wish you'd had at the beginning of this journey that you could share with others?
Get plenty of sleep. It's all the things that your parents told you when you were little. Eat right, get exercise, get fresh air, sleep. Is it Robert Fulghum? Everything you ever learned in kindergarten, or everything you ever needed to know, you learned in kindergarten. It's those basics that sustain your sanity. You will get exhausted. You will get frustrated. There are so many decisions to make, large and small, from what to throw into a hospital go bag to, can my loved one come back to this living situation where we are? Is this going to work? Or should I be figuring something else out? It's a roller coaster. You just need to take it a step at a time and trust yourself and be forgiving. You're going to make mistakes. There's no way to do it perfectly.
It's true. And everyone does. And that's part of the love. But I'm curious, did you learn some valuable ways that caregivers can care for themselves during a process like this? Because especially when you're really on your own, caring for a loved one, it can be very isolating. Did you learn ways to help to keep yourself sustained and strong?
I did. Well, I've mentioned journaling, very important
yes,
to me.
Yes, you did.
I also did a few meditation series, like 3 weeks long meditation series, 20 minutes a day. And that was wonderful for my head. And very much not who I normally am or what I normally do. I am too antsy to sit still for 20 minutes, just listening to not even music, chimes and saying a certain syllable over and over again. But it was really helpful to just be still and to let my head and my heart all get into the same rhythm. That was really, really important. Breathing exercises, breathing in joy and love and confidence and strength, and then breathing out as if my lungs were a sponge, fear, frustration, anger, grief, and just really emptying my lungs completely and then breathing in again, grace and blessings and gratitude. That was really helpful, especially if I was awake in the middle of the night and, you know, my heart's racing, my head is racing, and I just stop and make myself do the breathing exercises. And usually by the fourth inhale in, I was asleep, just really quieted everything down. It was really useful.
And tell us, how is your husband doing now, and what does he think of the book?
He's very supportive of the book, which is wonderful. In general, his health is great. He's going to be taking upwards of 150 pills a week for the rest of his life.
Ugh.
And on occasion, he annoys me, and it's really wonderful. So, yeah, we have it when we, on occasion, we get a little short with each other for whatever reason, because that's what you do after you've been married for decades. Yeah. And we stop and we look at each other, and oftentimes he'll just do something like he'll walk over to the stairs and he'll go up two or three stairs and say, look at me doing reciprocal steps. And it's just it takes the snark out of the air and makes us both laugh. And you realize that in the scheme of things, our problems are really quite small. We are very, very blessed and very lucky.
Are you writing another book? Will you now that this is published and your lovely reviews have come in?
Oh, thank you. Someone had a suggestion for a sequel, and I can't remember what it was, but it had something to do with, I think it was, and now he's annoying me, or something like that.
That's the most happy, realistic ending I think we could hope for.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
Sarah Cart is the author of On My Way Back to You, One Couple's Journey Through Catastrophic Illness to Healing and Hope. Ms. Cart, how can our listeners learn more about you and your work? Do you have a social media account or a website for the book?
There is a website for the book. It is www.sarahcart.com, or you can get there at www.onmywaybacktoyou.com. And I'm not sure if there's a message on there yet or not about how important organ donation is. A family in what has to have been their darkest hours turned their tragedy into our miracle, as well as several other patients that same day. And it's a debt that we will never be able to repay, but it's just been miraculous and wonderful.
So. On that note, thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations on the book and congratulations on your husband's health and all the new skills you've developed. Really a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was wonderful talking with you, John.
And we'll be right back.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome back to Sirius XM. I'm John Fugelsang. Now, you probably already know this, but 85% of beef processing in this country is controlled by four companies. 83% of the cold cereal industry is currently dominated by three companies. 70% of the carbonated soft drink market controlled by two companies. And 80% of the baby formula market is controlled by two companies. Joe Biden's not one of them. Unchecked corporate consolidation results in labor workers being exploited, our environment being degraded, food being less healthy, and the population being less healthy with a deeply dysfunctional supply chain. Now, in 2008, the groundbreaking Oscar-nominated documentary Food, Inc. was released, and it set off a cultural conversation about these multinational corporations that control our food system and are the reason so many poor people are obese because they eat garbage that comes in a box. The film was, you'll recall, narrated by Eric Schlosser and Michael Pollan, and Food, Inc. was a great feat of journalism, activism, filmmaking, and soothsaying, highlighting the profits over sustainability that has blighted our industrialized food system. The film was up for an Oscar. It won an Emmy. It's one of the most powerful moral and political films you'll ever see. And now, Eric Schlosser and Michael Pollan have rejoined forces for Food, Inc. 2. It's a critical global call to action. It takes a fresh look at our vulnerable food system to show how corporate consolidation has gone unchecked by both parties, leaving us with a highly efficient and shockingly vulnerable food system that's really dedicated only towards one thing, more profits for the wealthy. It is the best film I've seen so far this year, and you don't even need to see the first one to see Food, Inc. 2. Now, Eric Schlosser is an investigative journalist and the author of Fast Food Nation, Reefer Madness, and Command and Control, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It is a great pleasure to welcome Mr. Schlosser to Sirius XM. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, and thank you for saying such nice things about these films.
Oh, well, I mean, it's just dynamite. And my wife's a vegetarian. She was afraid to watch, and she was transfixed. I mean, it's quite a feat that a film with this much disturbing content can also be this beautiful and this entertaining. But I gotta say, it would be wonderful or naive to think that the first Food, Inc. would be the only film needed on this topic. And I've been dying to ask you, of all the changes that have taken place over the past 16 years and the problems that were exacerbated by the pandemic, what specifically motivated you to want to make this sequel?
Well, the pandemic really revealed a lot of the fundamental problems with our food system and how fragile it was. You know, many people may have forgotten, but there was a real scramble for people to get food, long lines at supermarkets. And at the same time, the production system began to break down and farmers were forced to slaughter thousands and thousands of hogs because they had reached a certain size and needed to be processed. And if they got any bigger, these huge industrial slaughterhouses couldn't handle the hogs anymore, and milk was being dumped. And it showed, you know, that behind the surface, there were just fundamental problems with our food system. What got me extraordinarily angry was the way that immigrant meatpacking workers, mainly immigrant meatpacking workers, were being sacrificed at the height of COVID so that the meatpacking companies could continue shipping product out the door. Meatpacking companies in rural America, and oddly enough, the prisons in rural America, became major vectors for COVID when COVID was at its deadliest and most dangerous. And the logical thing to do would have been what a public health official in Colorado tried to do, which was shut down a slaughterhouse that was, you know, spreading COVID not only to the workers, but to the community. The meatpacking industry did not want to shut down its slaughterhouses, and particularly with beef. The cattle can be slaughtered at all sizes and weights, so there was nothing urgent about it. So the meatpacking industry got the president of the United States, Donald Trump, to sign an executive order basically saying local public health officials couldn't shut down meatpacking plants under the Defense Production Act. And that executive order was literally written by the legal department at Tyson Foods, one of the largest meatpacking companies. So here you had hardworking, largely immigrant meatpacking workers dying, being sickened, suffering permanent disability, just so that Tyson and JBS and the other meatpacking companies would not suffer any decline in their profits.
That's it. I mean, this is such a labor issue and such a morality issue. Your partner in this bill, Michael Pollan, recently said, "I think the people who feed us are invisible to us most of the time. Food seems cheap at the register, but we don't pay the true cost." And I want to ask you about that, because I completely agree. This is true both in terms of fresh produce and garbage fast food. But is it inevitable that healthy food depends on an exploited workforce?
It's not inevitable at all. And let's just, one of the big issues right now is there's a debate in California because California passed a minimum wage for fast food workers. And let's get into why they did that. Before the minimum wage for fast food workers was passed recently, the median wage of a fast food worker in California, that means half below and half above, was $15,000 a year. And one third of the fast food workers in California were receiving some form of public assistance, many of them food stamps, Medicaid. And what that means is the taxpayers were paying for the healthcare and often the food of fast food workers. Simultaneous to that, the head of McDonald's was earning $20 million a year. Now, his employees are earning $15,000. He's earning $20 million. You do the math. The typical fast food worker in California would have to work 1,300 years just to earn what the head of McDonald's earned in a single year. So these companies have become very good at passing their business costs along to society, whether it's through their workers having to be on food stamps, whether it's through the foodborne illnesses that people suffer that comes from contaminated food, and on and on and on. The Rockefeller Foundation did a study that showed Americans spend roughly $1 trillion a year on food. But if you look at all the other costs being imposed on society by this industrial food system, it's actually $3 trillion. So $2 trillion aren't even on the menu. And in the 70s, you know, the environmental movement, which was trying to end pollution, came up with a principle, the polluter pays, which means you can't just dump toxic chemicals in a river, and if people get sick downriver, who cares? And we really need to do the same thing with the food system, which is that these food companies need to bear the costs of what they're imposing on society.
That's it. I mean, I also think that most Americans who use the drive-thru would be willing to turn their 99-cent menu into a $1.05 menu if they knew that extra 6 pennies was going to be providing a living wage to the people who prepare and serve their food. I think most Americans would get behind this.
Yeah. And so, I mean, there's a group that we chronicle in the film, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is a Florida-based farm worker group that's exactly doing that. It got the huge purchasers of tomatoes like Burger King and Taco Bell and Walmart to pay an extra penny a pound for their tomatoes. And that didn't increase the cost of a slice of tomato on a hamburger at Burger King. But by paying an extra penny a pound for the tomatoes, with that extra penny going to the farm workers, it eliminated poverty among those tomato harvesters. So
yeah.
I wouldn't bother doing this work or sticking in this subject for decades unless I really felt that change was necessary, but also change was possible. And it really is possible. None of these problems are inevitable, but people need to know what's going on and then need to try to do something about it.
Exactly. And that's why the film is so important. I mean, people might assume that these are films about food, and they are, but more importantly, this is a story about power. Those who wield it, those who support yeah. and are bought and paid for by those who wield it, and how its consolidation in the hands yeah. of a few affects all of us. And you point out in the film, no competition, then the CEOs get paid more, the farmers get paid less, the consumers pay more. Why was it important to give a reminder to your audience of why AT&T was broken up?
One of the main themes of the film is the dangers of monopoly power and consolidation or concentration or other ways of saying it. But, you know, this was a lesson that we learned more than a century ago. In the 1890s, almost every sector of the American economy was controlled by a monopoly or by a trust. And beginning with Teddy Roosevelt and throughout the 20th century, we had antitrust policy that broke up these gigantic corporations that really made sure there was real competition, and good things come when you have competition. In the case of AT&T, there were all these arguments that the phone company had to be a monopoly. And as soon as you get rid of AT&T, you have cellular phones, you have the World Wide Web, you have all kinds of innovation. And if people want a very good contemporary example of what's wrong with monopoly power, all they need to do is look at Boeing. In the 1970s, we had three major manufacturers of passenger aircraft: Boeing, Lockheed, McDonnell Douglas. Now we only have Boeing. There is an arrogance and an incompetence and a lack of innovation that comes with this sort of monopoly power. Boeing was, you know, deliberately cutting back on spending on safety, giving the money to shareholders instead and executives. And look what happened. And the thing that's really outrageous is the head of Boeing, who was on the board for the years when so many of these problems were being created, and he just stepped down as the head of Boeing, and he got a $30 million payout to step down.
Yeah.
So there really were no consequences for him, but there were huge consequences for the people who were on those 737s that crashed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the food system is a very good way to look at the bigger problems in society. It's not just the food system. It's just about every other sector of our economy.
Correct.
And it's very deceptive because these huge companies now market under dozens of different brand names. So you think that there are dozens of different competing companies, but it's actually only one or two or three.
That's probably the most devastating thing about the film. I mean, a year and a half ago, we were talking about the baby formula shortage in this country. And we were talking about it in the media exclusively in political terms. How hard can they blame Joe Biden for this? How soon can Joe Biden fix it? This film is really the first to focus on the fact that this is not directly the fault of politicians. This is the fault of consolidation and the politicians who've enabled it.
Yeah, it's the fault of the amount of money in politics that has allowed this consolidation to happen without any pushback. And I just wrote a piece for The Atlantic magazine that just got posted today about consolidation and about that infant formula recall. I mean, the factory There are four companies that control 99% of the infant formula in the United States. And there was one factory in Sturgis, Michigan. This one factory was producing 20% of all the powdered infant formula that infants in America were eating. This factory was filthy. It was being run with equipment dating back to the 1960s. And for months, there was a whistleblower at the factory who was warning, this place is being improperly run. It's going to endanger children. Nothing was done about it. And when they shut down that factory, we suddenly had shortages of infant formula throughout the United States. And the moral of that story is, A, there are some companies that are willing to take the risk of poisoning infants for profit. And B, you need a diverse competitive market so that there are 15 companies making infant formula. And if one of them has a problem at one of their factories, there's no threat of children not eating. And this is a lesson that we learned a century ago and we're relearning now. But, you know, you can create competitive markets again. You just have to be able and willing to take on these powerful corporations, which so many of the politicians who are getting huge donations from them are unwilling to do.
That's it. I mean, early in the film, you show a scene with a small dairy farmer. They're pressured to get as much milk as humanly possible per day out of 450 cows. 450 yeah. cows, and they're in the small business. They're up against the 10,000 cow dairy. And
20,000.
It's insane. I mean, yeah. And people don't realize when you eat a hamburger, you're probably not eating a cow. You're probably eating parts of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cows because these are mass.
It could be thousands.
Factories. Thousands of cows in one yeah. burger because it is so widespread. And, you know, you cover the Tyson plant in Florida, and these are the stories that our media should be giving us, especially yeah. during a pandemic. Is it advertising dollars that make the corporate media stay away from vitally important stories like these?
You know, it's advertising dollars, but it's also the threat of lawsuits. I mean, the meatpacking companies are really tough. They were willing to sue Oprah Winfrey at the height of her popularity and fame. A number of states, thanks to these big agribusiness companies, have passed what are called veggie libel laws that okay. makes it illegal to criticize the agricultural products of these states. Those laws are clearly unconstitutional, but honestly, I don't want to be the one that has to take the case to the Supreme Court after I've been sued under one of those laws. So,
yeah,
you know, power corrupts. It's a very old idea. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Absolutely. And, you know, we have a form of corporate socialism in America. This is not capitalism. Anyway, people need to know about this and do something about it. And the Biden administration, to its credit, is trying to revive antitrust enforcement and, you know, is trying to block the merger of America's two biggest supermarket chains, Kroger and Albertsons. And I think they may have a good shot at that. So all is not lost. And there are grounds for hope, but things are not just going to change for the better on their own. It takes an educated and informed electorate and then people acting upon what they've learned.
You are also the filmmakers launching a multifaceted campaign to raise awareness about farm workers' rights and corporate consolidation in ultra-processed foods.
Yes.
How can people who see the film and want to learn more find out about it?
Well, Participant Media, who is one of the producers of the film, has a website connected to Food Inc. that talks about these campaigns. And, you know, in the simplest sense, you can be much more conscious when you're buying food to try to avoid ultra-processed foods. There are health problems that are being linked to ultra-processed foods, something like 40 or 50 different ailments. And a good rule of thumb would be, if you look at the list of ingredients, you don't know what one of those ingredients are. It's some weird chemical name. You probably don't have it in your kitchen. It's probably not a good idea to eat it. I mean, Michael Pollan's rule is eat real food, mainly plants, not so much. And I think that's still true. In terms of farm workers, the coalition of Immokalee workers is expanding throughout the United States. And there's all kinds of ways to help immigrants in your community who are being portrayed as dangerous, scary people by some politicians, but who are actually in many ways the backbone of our food system. And on antitrust, support politicians who believe in freedom and competition.
Amen. This is a deeply moral movie about labor, about health, about threats to democracy and our way of life, about the horrible way some corporations treat animals and the horrible way people are suckered into treating their own stomachs and colons. I didn't get to half of my questions. Yeah. Honestly, this is such a great film and I can't wait to see it again. Eric Schlosser, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for making Food Inc. 2 a reality.
Thanks so much, man. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Thank you.